Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. It's happened to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be those of Mr. John Williams, who is an economist, and he has a website called shadowstatistics.com. Now, several years ago, the Federal Reserve Board stopped publishing the M3 statistics. Now, to many people, that doesn't mean much of anything, but M3 is actually the vehicle by which you can determine what the government is really doing as far as promoting inflation. What it has to do with certainly all the money and all the credit that's out there in the system. And is the government restricting money? Is it expanding money? Are we on an inflationary binge? Are we beginning to cut back from an inflationary binge? What is the significance of the unemployment statistics? Are we getting the truth? Is the government telling us what's really going on? Or do they have a hidden plan, a secret plan? Well, that's what Mr. Williams does. He compiles the statistics that the government's not giving us, and hopefully he's giving us the adequate statistics so we will really understand what's taking place. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me with you.
Well, I want you to tell us what's happening as far as the M3 is concerned. I have seen some charts that show a dramatic fall in M3, but what they are is a chart of the statistics of the percentage of increase of the M3. And so, I mean, why would you chart something like the increase of M3 and the decrease of M3 or percentage rather than just what the M3 is? It seems that sometimes these charts we see can lead us astray.
Well, there are many different ways of looking at the numbers, but what you have to keep in mind with M3, which in recent years has been, at least traditionally, the broadest measure of the money supply. The money supply basically reflects inflation. It's the amount of currency that circulates and doesn't have to be cash. There are different levels of money supply. M1 includes currency and checking accounts, and M2 includes the smaller savings accounts. M3, the broadest measure, includes generally the largest of the accounts, such as the jumbo CDs and institutional money funds. The Fed stopped publishing the broader measure back in 2006, they said, had really no meaning, and they couldn't afford to continue publishing it.
I mean, here's a multi-billion organization, dollar organization, with unlimited access to money, and they said that they just couldn't afford to publish it?
It was too expensive.
All right, too expensive. Do you think that was...
And as expensive as it was, they still track most of the components, which is why I'm able to put together an estimate of what's actually happening with it. And the reason for looking at M3... is that when you start to see rapid growth in it, you start also to see rapid inflation or a pickup in inflation. Usually there's a lag time there of 9 months to a year, which we are well into at this point in time.
Well, what is happening to M3? Are we headed towards inflation?
Right now you said why level or why the percentage change. When you look at inflation, you usually think of it in terms of percentage change. Right now, as the government's reporting the Consumer Price Index, it does have a couple of measures. The broadest measure, the one that's popular in the press.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment. Mr. John Williams, what does the future hold? We'll go right ahead.
There?
Go right ahead now.
Okay. The... right now, the government, as it's reporting, the broadest measure of the consumer price index is looking at 5.6% inflation as it's measured year over year. So if you're looking at inflation on that basis, you generally would look at a year-to-year change in the broad money supply. And although the growth has slowed a little bit in recent months, right now we're at 14% year-over-year, which historically is extremely high.
Now, this is the M3 that you're speaking of?
This is the M3.
Okay, fine.
In terms of year-to-year percent change.
But that's really down from about 18%.
It got up to 17, a little over 17%. And you're going to see some ups and downs, and I'll explain why. But to put this into perspective, what we've seen in the last several months has been the highest growth in the money supply that's been seen in, since June of 1971, when Nixon was president, and it was about 2 months before he closed the gold window, cutting off all the foreign convertibility of the dollar and the gold, and before he imposed wage and price controls. Again, real high money growth usually leads to high inflation. What happened about a year ago is that the banking system began to fall apart. And Mr. Bernanke, current Fed chairman, stepped in to salvage the system. And I'll contend he's going to do whatever he has to do to keep the banking system from collapsing. If he lets the system collapse, which I'll contend is not a viable option for him, if that should happen, you would see something similar to what happened in the 1930s when the banking system collapsed then. The money supply crashed, and with it you went into a deflation. In order to have a deflation, the money supply has to contract. We haven't seen any contraction in the money supply here. So with that action, you would have had a deflationary Great Depression, something similar to the 1930s, although there would have been a number of differences. By keeping the banks from collapsing, by supporting their solvency, keeping them in business, the Fed has had to do quite a number of things, including lending good quality assets to banks for bad quality assets that the banks are holding, so the banks can continue to lend money.
Hold that thought for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly John Williams, who does track the government statistics and, of course, tries to give us an accurate appraisal of what's going on. John has said that the M3, which is an evaluation of all the money and credit that's out there, had been up to well over 17%. It's down now to 14%. In other words, the amount of new money that they're putting in is about 14%. They're certainly not increasing it as rapidly as they have in the past. So this is cut back, not a great deal, but it simply gives us an idea that they're certainly they're trying to stabilize the monetary system. On the other hand, why we have, of course, everything being done now using a tremendous amount of money to try to stabilize the banks, because the whole banking system is on the verge of collapse, and if that were to happen, we'd end up like we did back in the 1930s. So please proceed with what you were saying, John.
Sure. Well, even at 14%, that is very strong growth, and it's very inflationary. You will see some variation, and the reason that the growth is slowing, it isn't that the money supply is contracting or that M3 is contracting. It's just not growing quite as fast month to month as it was last year when the banking crisis was beginning to break. And as we go forward, I think you're going to see that pick up again, because the Fed, the Treasury, are all moving now to pump a lot more cash into the system to take over troubled institutions to convert the bad assets to good assets. I mean, last weekend, the government took over Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. There's something happening this weekend, most likely with a couple of institutions. The cost to saving the system, and I think they've I think they'll save the system at least for a while, and they've certainly been successful so far, is inflation. Because in order to save the system, they have to pump more liquidity into it. The money growth will be picking up again in terms of year-to-year growth. And that, in turn, means higher inflation down the road. The Fed's primary function at this point in time is not to contain inflation. It's not to prop up the economy. It's to keep the banking system afloat. And everything else is secondary in its concerns. And again, the cost for saving the banking system down the road is inflation. The times are extraordinary. I've never seen markets like this. I'll contend they're not natural, that they're not, we're not necessarily seeing open markets. You have a lot of unusual countercurrents going on in the background, a lot of interventions with the government and the big banking houses. A couple of things to consider with this process that we're seeing here. You know, I'm not a big fan of fiat currencies. I like to see a currency backed by something like gold. We haven't had that in a long time. But since we're on a fiat system, the way the current system is set up with these the Federal Reserve notes, you look in your wallet and you pull out a dollar bill and it says a Federal Reserve note on it. There actually is some backing to that. And the backing to that is U.S. Treasury securities that are held by the Federal Reserve. So you could at least say it's backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. Treasury.
But now the Federal Reserve is not the U.S. Treasury.
Oh,
the
no.
Federal Reserve is a privately owned central bank.
Indeed it is. But they hold in reserve, they hold on their balance sheet notes from the U.S. Treasury that they use as collateral as backup value for the Federal Reserve notes.
Well, now, of course, my understanding is that the Federal Reserve is using up an awful lot of that capital, you know, in the process of trying to preserve the banking system.
Well, that's exactly the point, because where the dollar bill that you hold in your hand used to be backed by U.S. Treasuries, maybe 30-40% of that right now is backed by mortgage-backed securities.
And a lot of those
know if that gives anyone any pause for thought or such, but... And I'm not saying that the mortgage-backed securities are much worse than what eventually will happen to the U.S. Treasuries, but the U.S. Treasuries are considered the safest instrument on Earth, and I'll contend there's some problems there down the road. But we're seeing all sorts of things being done to the system that few people are paying much attention to.
Well, now, aren't a lot of these mortgage-backed securities you're speaking of that are used then to back up our monetary system, aren't these the so-called toxic garbage that really isn't much of any good and not going to be able to do a payoff? And, of course, they're backed by mortgages on houses that are declining in value.
Yep, that's right. And eventually they're going to be cashed out, paid out, money created. I mean, there's going to be... The system will be backed, but the process is the process involves creation of money. A couple of years ago, Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke addressed the risks of deflation in the United States. Again, thinking back to the Great Depression, and he made the point that the Fed could always prevent deflation. And the way they could do that, very simply, was by revving up the printing presses. And he says, of course, we don't really use the printing presses that much. It's more electronic these days. The effect is absolutely the same. And this is our Fed chairman. He wasn't Fed chairman then. He's just a member of the Board of Governors. But he was... As he explained it very simply, and he's absolutely right, and he knows what he has to do here, unfortunately, is that the money that is created, as long as they create enough extra money, it will debase the value of the dollar. If you create too much of something, it drops in, against demand, it drops in value. And where the dollar drops in value, and its purchasing power, that's just another way of saying inflation. You reverse it. The Fed can create inflation by creating money. And what they're doing now is not necessarily deliberately creating money to stimulate inflation. They are creating money. Or they're getting set to create money. They're having the effect of creating money to keep the system afloat, to keep the system from collapsing.
Well, now, we saw certainly a few, maybe 6 months ago, where they came up with a wonderful idea. They were going to stimulate the economy to make it go by throwing in about, I think, 1.5, 1. I'm sorry, 100, 150, 160 billion dollars, and everybody got a nice check, and most people got a nice check. They went out and spent the check, and they gave certain benefits to the corporations to try to stimulate the economy. Did that work for a time? Is it still working today?
Not really. I mean, it had to have some positive stimulus, but not much, because if you're trying to get people to spend money, if you look at retail sales, which represents what people are doing in terms of going out to stores and buying clothes or appliances or buying automobiles, whatever. And you adjust that for inflation. We just had numbers yesterday that brought the inflation, the retail sales numbers up through the month of July. If you adjust the retail sales numbers for inflation, and the reason you'd look at it that way, that's the same way that the broad economy is looked at. The GDP, which is the broadest measure, is reported in inflation-adjusted terms. And if you had basic growth in economic activity of 5% and you had 10% inflation on that, and you're seeing 15% growth in the economy, if you didn't take the inflation out, you wouldn't be getting a meaningful picture. You'd be seeing growth that was dominated by inflation. So they take inflation out of it. If you take inflation out of retail sales, and now retail sales are contracting month to month, even before inflation adjustment, what's happened is on a quarterly basis, again, that's the way the GDP is measured, you've seen quarter-to-quarter contractions for four consecutive quarters, with July down, these were August retail sales, with July and August down, virtual certainty that the third quarter is going to be down. You have five consecutive quarters of contracting retail sales. On a year-over-year basis, how are retail sales doing this year against last year? That's been in contraction for the last two quarters. If you look at, I'm just using government's numbers. If you look at the payroll figures, that's been contracting month to month since December. It's down two quarters in a row. Year to year, it's now negative. If you look at new orders for durable goods, which is sort of a surrogate for how the industrial side is doing, this includes orders for automobiles, aircraft, tanks, dishwashers, whatever, products that are designed to last for a while. Even before inflation, you're seeing quarter-to-quarter contractions and also year-to-year contractions. The reason I mention that is you've never seen those patterns outside of a formal recession. We are in a recession. And those retail sales, they kept sinking quarter to quarter, year to year. Now, there was a little bit of a relative blip. The contraction was not quite as sharp when those stimulus payments went out, but it didn't even get the consumption into positive territory. And when the government says that the GDP is growing along at a pace of about 3% after inflation, that's frankly absolutely unbelievable.
Well, is it true, or are they simply cooking the books?
As best I can tell, they're cooking the books. I can't prove it. I can just make certain deductions, and I can give you circumstantial evidence, such as, well, retail sales are contracting, durable goods are contracting, employment's down. And these are all major indicators of what's happening with economic activity. There have been times in the past where I know for sure there's been a direct manipulation.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Mr. John Williams of ShadowStatistics.com. Well, the thing is that, you know, they put out $160 billion, $150 billion, $160 billion, you know, to try to stimulate the economy. Where did that money come from? The government's having to borrow money from other countries just to pay its bills. So where did that $160 billion come from?
Well, exactly as you said, borrowing it from other countries. It's we have serious debt problems. Just one correction there. There is called Shadow Government Statistics, and the website is Shadow Stats, not Shadow Statistics.
You're right. I stand corrected. Thank you so much.
.com.
Okay.
So people don't start giving you calls or me calls trying to figure out how to get to it.
Well, we will actually, of course, get that information out for all of our listeners here when we have everybody on board. So basically, of course, we're just borrowing money so we can give money away with the hope it's going to stimulate the economy. You think they're going to do that again and again, trying to get the economy going? But it's really not going to get going, is it?
Well, it hasn't gotten going, and it has done nothing to change the underlying fundamentals for the average American. And indeed, is a great danger as to what's going to be ahead of us in terms of inflation in the near future. I mean, we've been buying stability in the dollar by effectively having, despite this terrible trade deficit that we have, by effectively forcing foreign central banks to take the excess dollars they're holding and to come back and buy the U.S. Treasuries. As long as they do that, the system's been holding together. But again, if you're a foreign central bank and you're looking at the dollar, you know you've got a losing proposition there down the road, and ideally you'd like to get out of those dollars. The thing is, if all the foreign central banks decided to dump their dollars, the dollar would drop sharply in value. They liquidated the treasuries they're holding. Interest rates would spike sharply. Federal Reserve would have to come in, either raise interest rates, which they don't really want to do at this point, or they would start buying the treasuries themselves and again start spiking the money supply, which again will give you higher inflation. I mean, all the solutions here that the government tends to be pursuing or likely will have to pursue leads to higher inflation. But that foreign buying of U.S. treasuries is extraordinary. If you go back over the last 6 years, what you'll find is that the foreign investors have basically purchased about 80% of the net issuance of the U.S. Treasury. I mean, they are literally funding the annual deficit on a cash basis. And that has had beneficial effects to our markets. Again, it's kept liquidity flowing in many areas. It's helped keep interest rates down. It's helped fuel the stock market despite the stock market's recent weakness. And again, once you start to see the reversal there and heavy selling of the dollar and dumping of the dollar-held assets by those foreign central banks, wherever we are in the market cycles here, you will start to see a sharp spike in interest rates hit on equities and such. Again, a very dangerous circumstance. And as you look down the road, it actually becomes nightmarish. I don't like to use terms like that. I'm really a very optimistic, happy person.
Well, hold that thought for just a moment. We'll bring our other stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Mr. Williams is saying, as you look down the road, it looks almost nightmarish. Now, he says he doesn't like to use those terms because he's an optimistic person, but certainly right now, it is foreign central banks that are buying up American T-bills, that are buying up American debt, and keeping our system going. We are no longer a sovereign nation. We're dependent upon foreign central banks to keep the whole system going, and we're having to borrow money every single day, a couple of billion dollars every day just to pay our bills. And it seems that people in Washington, D.C. can hardly wait to come up with another idea of how they're going to spend more money. We've recently committed ourselves to absorbing the debts of Fannie Mae and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and of course we're talking, they say, well, it was originally $20 billion, and then they were talking about $200 billion, and then they're talking about $300 billion, and there may be a lot more than that. I mean, they've got about $5 to $6 trillion in debts, and certainly a fair amount of that is going to turn bad. Would that be your estimate as time goes by?
It gets a lot worse.
All right. Well, why don't we get your thoughts on that, because you're much more of an expert than I am. So where do we really stand as we see the collapse of the housing market and, of course, all these bonds out there, which is really what Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are holding, are mortgages that are not performing on property that's rapidly losing value?
The crisis there has exacerbated the circumstance. It didn't create it. The government effectively already was bankrupt before the housing crisis, before the mortgage crisis. And it has to do with years of the government in Washington, both major parties, basically giving in to the political expediency of trying to give people anything that they want without any consideration of the cost or where the funds are going to come from. If you go back to the 1970s, the Big Ten accounting firms got together with the Congress and said, hey, look, guys, there's no reason the U.S. government, which is the largest business on earth, shouldn't be keeping its books the same way a big corporation does, and using generally accepted accounting principles. And the accountants worked with the Congress, and they eventually came up with a bookkeeping system that has been put in place, and for the last 6 years or so, the federal government has been publishing, published by the U.S. Treasury, signed off on by the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, as audited by what used to be called the General Accounting Office. Now it's the Government Accountability Office, the GAO. And what those statements show is absolutely shocking, because instead of seeing a couple of $100 billion a year deficit, which is the way it gets reported, actually this year it's going to be up over $400 billion. It's rising even as it's been reported in gimmick terms. The numbers show that over the last 6 years, that the deficits actually averaged about $4 trillion. That's with a T, not a B. Per year.
$4 trillion a year.
$4 trillion a year. The big difference there probably is not too big a shocker. Again, keep in mind that the way the official deficit's reported, it's just on a cash basis. What do we receive in cash? What do we put out in cash? And what they receive in cash includes the Social Security taxes that are being paid. So they count that as regular income, but they don't show the liability to Social Security as an offset, as an offsetting expense. You see that in the in generally accepted accounting principles. And not only that, but you also, with the more traditional accounting, account for the unfunded liabilities in the future. And the way that's worked is that the actuaries for the Social Security system, for Medicare, work out how short the fund is going to be, how short the fund is in terms of projected income and outlays, and they discount the future value of money there. I mean, if I offer you $10 10 years from now, that's not as valuable to you as if I offer you $10 today. So they discount the future value of the money, and then they look at that net unfunded liability as it changes year to year, and that goes up or down. That's either counted as an expense or an income item. With the effect that $4 trillion, somewhere around $3.5 trillion is tied to the changes year to year in the unfunded liabilities of Social Security and Medicare. To put that into perspective, let's say the government said, okay, we're going to balance the budget this year in real terms, the way most companies would keep their books. If they raised the taxes and took 100% of everyone's income and corporate profits, they'd still be in deficit.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Mr. John Williams. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest John Williams of ShadowStats.com, that's ShadowStats.com, and he was just saying that they took 100% of all of our salaries and all of the corporate profits, we would still not have enough money to pay the debts that we're accruing under standard accounting rules. Would that be the fair statement?
That is a fair statement. Now, of course, there are two ways you can bring it into balance. One is to increase revenues, which would be taking everyone's income, which obviously they can't do. The other end of it is to cut the expenses and to slash Social Security, Medicare payments. And I'll contend that the environment in Washington and the leading candidates for the office of president are not willing to address slashing Social Security or Medicare. So that what happens here, what usually happens to countries that spend beyond their means, beyond what they can possibly ever raise in taxes, is that they don't default on debt, or they don't miss making their payments or paying their obligations. What they tend to do is, excuse me, to quote Mr. Bernanke, is rev up the printing presses and pay off with cheap dollars. The government can create as much currency as it wants to, pays it off, but the currency becomes worthless. And effectively, what is currently high inflation becomes something along the lines of hyperinflation.
Well, because that means, though, that you wipe out the annuities, you wipe out the pension funds, you wipe out the savings, you wipe out the insurance.
Yep.
You wipe out everything that is related to the dollar simply by that sort of approach. But then, didn't Mr. Bernanke actually advocate that at one time? He said, you know, if we had to, we had to fight deflation, we could always just throw money out of a helicopter.
Right. Well, I said we had to fight deflation.
Right, I'm sorry.
You're absolutely right. That's the same speech where he mentioned the printing presses. I think he likely regrets having made those comments and using those words, because he picked up the nickname Helicopter Ben as a result. And that's going to live with him for the rest of his life. But effectively, that's what the Fed doesn't have the choice in the matter. I mean, that's the easy political out. The tough political out is either to savage the government spending programs, or default on debt, which would have the same effect as eventually throwing you into a hyperinflationary Great Depression.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris said Mr. Williams is saying that, you know, if they go ahead and they keep printing money to prevent us from getting into a deflation, why, first, they're going to create a runaway type of inflation and suddenly destroy the value of our currency. So what alternative? Are they going to be able to pull the rabbit out of the hat and get this thing under control, do you think?
No. I mean, I'm not a politician, and politicians won't usually address things like this unless they have a solution, or at least something they can propose in the way of a solution. I wish I had a solution. I think it's gone beyond containment, beyond control, and that you're effectively going to have a financial crash of unprecedented proportion with a hyperinflationary depression. And as to the people in Washington, they know what's going on. I don't think anyone there really wants to see this happen, but being able to just spend whatever money is needed to try and please the public has been such an easy way for the politicians to stay in office that they're addicted to it. Just consider, for example, I think it was back in 2004 when Medicare was overhauled and the prescription benefits were put in. At that point in time, when that system was set up, it was set up with something like $8 trillion of unfunded liabilities. Government knew exactly what it was doing. It knew it could never pay for the system it was setting up. It was shy $8 trillion today of what was needed to make ends meet on that. Yet they put it into play. And at that point in time, effectively doubled. That was the order of magnitude of the total government debt at that time. We're up at $10 trillion now in terms of the what's been issued in the way of Treasury notes and such. But when you add all the other obligations in place, that takes you over $60 trillion right now, and that's more than four times the level of the GDP. In fact, it's probably more than the total GDP of the entire world. Again, it's just beyond unbelief, beyond containment, and an ultimate destroyer of the value of the U.S. dollar. I wish I could give you a way out of it, but we've spent beyond what we can contain. And I mean, the other end of it, in terms of cutting it back, could create such political problems. I just don't see anyone working it.
Well, now some people,
there's no happy solution to this.
Well, now some people are saying, though, that we're moving towards, rather than inflation, deflation. They're pointing out that the other price of food commodities has fallen. The price of standard commodities of copper, zinc, and these other things has fallen. The price of gold and silver has fallen. The price of oil has fallen. The price of certainly homes has fallen. The price of many of the other staples that we use has fallen. And they say this suggests more deflation than inflation.
I mean, they're not living in the same world that I am. In terms of the day-to-day goods and services, there's no question of there being an inflation in food, many components of day-to-day living. Oil prices spiked sharply a month or two ago, and then came down, but we're still well above anything ever seen historically. As long as oil's above, we're at $90, and we're still above that. You're looking at something that is very inflationary for the economy. In terms of gold and silver, frankly, I think we've seen manipulated markets. Again, I'm putting this into a big picture. You have right now probably the most dangerous financial circumstance any country's ever faced. And you have a central bank and a treasury doing their absolute best to keep the system from collapsing. I mean, there is risk of the system collapsing. If the system collapsed, if the banks collapsed, the money supply collapsed, then yes, you would have a deflation. But we're not seeing any collapse in the money supply. They're going to do everything they can. They're going to print every dollar they have to print. They're going to twist every arm that they have to twist. They're going to intervene in every market that they have to intervene in to keep the system afloat. Part of it is to discourage people from owning gold. If gold prices are rallying, it's a sign that the central banks are not doing their job. And you go back to the weekend when Bear Stearns was saved. I'm working on some details on this, but I think there very clearly was a massive coordinated intervention to boost the dollar, knock gold prices down. Well, right now, it should be much higher. There's also been intervention there. My goodness, you have a hurricane right now working its way through the Gulf of Mexico and battering the coast along Texas. And, my prayers and best wishes are with everyone that's exposed to that tonight. But you have, from a business economic standpoint, within that range, tremendous refinery capacity that's at risk, oil production that's at risk. I know gasoline prices at a wholesale level spiked sharply and regionally, but oil prices have come down. Same time, OPEC saying, we're going to cut production unexpectedly. Oil prices are coming down. That's not natural. If you look at the gold market, gold coins, there's a scarcity. Silver coins, I was talking to a coin dealer yesterday. He said he can't buy any silver coins from his suppliers. That's not a natural market. What has happened is that you've had large investment banks go in and very heavily sell electronically non-physical gold and silver to knock the price down. Why? This is part of the containment of the system, an effort to keep the financial markets from melting down, which in turn would help bring about a collapse of the banking system. Back after the 1987 crash, The president at that time, Reagan, created what was known as the Working Group on the Financial Markets, I think is the name. It's acquired sort of a popularized name as the Plunge Protection Team, headed by the Treasury Secretary, the head of the Federal Reserve, head of the SEC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and such. And their mission basically was to prevent disorderly markets. That was their mission. They're free to go in and intervene in any market that they want to. And in terms of what's been done, Greenspan actually was pretty open about it back at the time of the invasion of Iraq. No one was quite sure of the timing in that, and nobody wanted to see the markets disrupted by it. Excuse me. So as we were invading Iraq, and the financial people knew this was happening, and they were preparing for it with their Plunge Protection Team, they went in and they sold oil. They sold gold. They bought the dollar. They countered the market trends. They don't just intervene in the currency markets. They intervene in the stock market. They intervene in the gold market, the silver market, and you're not seeing natural markets now. I can't tell you what's going to happen to the markets in the near term. They're going all over the place. You're seeing wild gyrations. They're not natural. They appear irrational when you look at the underlying fundamentals, and I'll contend that the underlying fundamentals are as negative for traditional assets, such as stocks and bonds, and as positive for gold, silver, as negative as possible for the U.S. dollar, as have ever been seen. The fundamentals have not changed. So long range, long term, I'd almost bet my life, quite that far, you will see much higher gold prices, much higher silver prices, much weaker dollar. I mean, it's a virtual certainty. I just can't tell you when. But that's in the offing. In the near term, these markets can go any place, and I wouldn't look at them as reflecting anything in terms of underlying reality.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, we get a lot of statistics out about unemployment, you know, and unemployment is about, I think, is 6.1%, something like that. Are those accurate statistics, or are they lying to us about the level of unemployment?
It depends how you want to define unemployment. So it depends how you define what is means, I think, one of his statements. And his administration actually added to the definitions of the unemployment here. Basic concept of unemployment is someone who's unemployed, looking for work, wants to work, ready and able to work. Basically, if you meet those categories, you're counted as unemployed. Back in the Kennedy administration, they had a problem with the unemployment rate. And they came up with the idea of creating what they called a discouraged worker. This is a person who would otherwise be counted as unemployed, but they'd given up looking for work because there weren't any jobs to be had where they were. Companies moving offshore or whatever. And as you got into the 60s, the Bureau of Labor Statistics published a wide range of unemployment rates, ranging from what they had in the unemployment rate 1 up to an unemployment rate number 8. The one that's popularly followed, the 6.1% you're talking about, is the unemployment rate number 3. But since the Clinton administration, they can only go up to level 6. Level 6 is up over 10% right now. That's as reported by the government. But during the Clinton administration, they redefined the meaning of discouraged worker. This is just one of many games that have been played with these statistics over the years. The redefinition was that if you had been a discouraged worker, that meant being that you wanted to work, but you'd given up looking for work because there's no work to be had. If you'd been discouraged for more than a year, you were no longer counted in any of the statistics. And that had the effect of reducing the number of discouraged workers from something in the 4 to 5 million range down to the 400,000 to 500,000 range. So if you add back in the broad number of of discouraged workers, as they used to be defined, today's unemployment rate, the broadest measure, would be up around 14%.
There's really that sort of that old adage that figures don't lie, but liars can figure and give you just about any statistics you want. Is that,
sure
would that be a fair appraisal?
That's it. Is it legal?
Well,
actually, I think it is. I don't think there's any law against manipulating the statistics. What is illegal is someone outside of the Bureau preparing the numbers getting access to them before the markets close the day before. And there's a lot of evidence that that gets violated all the time, but nobody ever pursues it.
All right, fine. Well, of course, certainly right now we seem to find that banks are going under just about every weekend. I don't know how many banks have gone under this last month, but a fair number, half a dozen or so, and certainly some of our biggest banks, Lehman Brothers, Washington Mutual, others, are certainly just sort of hanging on desperately trying to raise funds, and they don't seem to be raising funds. Would that be a fair appraisal?
It sounds like it. I mean, I don't think I'd be wanting to invest money in anyone in the banking system at this point in time. That's a very dangerous time. What will happen here, I think, again, it gets back to my point, and it's the way I read the circumstance. But certainly the behavior of the government has been consistent with it. You can't believe everything that they say, because central bankers and finance ministers or treasury secretaries by nature almost have to lie in order to maintain some sense of stability in the financial markets. They will do anything they have to keep the system afloat. And that will mean keeping afloat institutions that, if they collapsed, would pull the market, would pull the system with them.
And that's then why, of course, they had to bail out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Bear Stearns and the others,
and
right?
I think the Treasury Secretary made comments today that, oh, we're not going to bail out, no federal bailout for Lehman. Well, one of two things. Either he's inexperienced and making a bad statement there, which I don't think he is, where he knows that something already is in place, where they've been twisting arms of someone, maybe a Chinese sovereign fund. I think that's one of the latest rumors. Who knows where it's going to come from. But somehow someone will come in and bail out Lehman. Now, when I say they bail out Lehman or any given bank, if you're looking at an operation that they can't let fail, what they would tend to do is to cover the depositors, people whose money is at risk at that level. In terms of bondholders, stockholders, I wouldn't want to be in a position of making a bet of having my stock worth anything down the road.
All right, fine. Well, before we go on, I do want you to get out your website and tell people about your newsletter, would you?
Sure. I publish a newsletter called Shadow Government Statistics. Our web address is shadowstats.com. Started this about the newsletter. I've been a consulting economist for 25 plus years, but the newsletter on the statistics has been in existence for about 4 years. What we do is look at the quality of the different government statistics, assess where the problems, give you an estimate of what's really happening with them. I publish alternate measures on the CPI, the GDP, different measures of the dollar. I continue to publish an estimate of the money supply, M3, which the federal government no longer does. Also give you an estimate of the unemployment rate based on the missing discouraged workers.
What is you consider the current rate of inflation at the present time?
Well, the government on its CPIU, which is all urban consumers, is up at 5.6%. That's official. The CPIW, which is based on wage earners, a slightly lower income group on average, it's up at 6.2%. The difference there is that the gasoline's a more important component of consumption. I normally wouldn't distinguish between the two, but there's right now a very large difference between the two. Because of methodological changes made in the way the CPI is reported over time, depending upon whether you look at the way it was prepared in 1990 or 1980, the numbers are somewhere between 3 percentage points and 7 percentage points shy. So I would contend that the real inflation is over 10%, perhaps as high as 13.
All right, you hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Mr. John Williams to wrap up the program. But certainly, if we're looking at 13% inflation, that is getting pretty high. In other words, it's eroding the value of everything you have, right, about 13%. But the government doesn't want the public to know. And so I believe they're simply cooking the books. Isn't that what a politician is supposed to do? Lie to the people?
Is that what they're supposed to do?
No, you go right ahead. We've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. That's what they do. They're not supposed to, but they do. You know, but their old adage, you can tell when a politician is lying because his lips are moving. But go right ahead.
Unfortunately, that's much too true. But most people know that. And that's why we've had such heavy traffic at our site. We have a lot of publicly available information, including a special report on the hyperinflation issue that I discussed with you as to why I think we're heading into a hyperinflation. Anyone interested can find that for reading on the site. And we do actually take subscriptions for anyone looking at the current outlook, but we also have an archives of earlier newsletters for people interested in seeing what's written there. People in Washington are not necessarily too fond of what I write. I guess that has to be expected. But I don't have any particular benefit in selling one concept or another here. I don't sell any stocks or bonds. The only thing I do sell is hopefully accurate information. And that's what I endeavor to do. And we'll always give you an assessment as to what's actually happening as we can. One thing you have to keep in mind, that is, with the popular financial media, most of the commentators that they have come off of Wall Street. And within Wall Street, there are a number of very fine economists. But you also, for the public consumption, often get commentaries that are close to a fairy tale.
Well, what do you think of Stephen Rhodes? Have you been following some of his recent predictions?
I'm sorry?
Stephen Rhodes. What do you think of Stephen Rhodes?
He's one of the good guys.
This is my impression, and he is he's rather pessimistic as far as the future is concerned. He thinks we've just begun to see the implosion of the housing market, and that's not that we're looking for a bottom. There's no bottom in sight.
I don't talk with him, but I have seen things in his analyses over time, and he's one off of Wall Street that is. He's an honest, good man.
And he was one of the senior economists there at Morgan Stanley. Anyways, we're just about out of time. I want to thank you very much, John, for being with us. It's always a pleasure, and I hope we can call on you from time to time.
You certainly can. Thank you so much for having me with you.
Good night, and God bless.
Same to you.
Bye-bye. All right, then, Chris, that was... Well, this Dr. Stan, that was John Williams, certainly an economist for 30 years who publishes shadow stats or shadow government statistics, but his website is shadowstats.com, www.shadowstats.com. He feels that the current rate, inflation rate is about maybe as high as 13%. He feels that the M3 has been fallen from about almost 18 down to about 14, but it is still, in other words, they're still massively increasing the amount of money out there. Not as bad as it was, but still massively increasing it, and of course that there is simply no way that they're ever going to get out of the situation that we're in today. So if you need more information on what's happening financially, I do have a talk we gave several years ago, but it's just as true today as it was when we gave it. It's called The Financial Tsunami. It comes with a syllabus if you want to get that, and that's The Financial Tsunami. We have a little pamphlet called The History of Money. And, of course, there's nothing new. The same thing happened in ancient Florence and ancient Venice. It happened in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and it's happening again here. It's happened in Germany. It's happening in Rhodesia today or Zimbabwe. It happened in Argentina just a few years ago, and people woke up one morning that lost three-quarters of the value of their currency. Their life savings was all gone one night, and then it was gone. People don't understand when you have a fiat money system, of course, you have a fraudulent money system. And it is wonderful. We have a system called the Federal Reserve System. It is a privately owned central bank. It has nothing to do with government. It is privately owned. And it is simply that it is designed by the bankers, for the bankers, to enrich the bankers. And those bankers buy and sell our politicians, including the presidents of the United States. Well, certainly the little pamphlet, The History of Money, are a pamphlet on the financial meltdown. These are just maybe 40 or 50 page pamphlets, easy to read, but a lot of verified information that you can check out. And then, of course, we have the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. If you haven't read it, you should. It explains to you that all the money we have today is based upon debt. And if you remove debt, there's no money there and the system collapses. And what we're finding is more and more, of course, of our money is just disappearing. We've already lost something like $50 to $16 trillion of the loss of the value of homes and loss of the values in the stock market. And the money is just disappearing because there's nothing behind it. It's all bank entries. So the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, is must reading for anybody who wants to really understand what's going on today. And I would comment, we sell several copies of this book literally every day. I think it's out of print, but it should be back in print. I mean, I'm sure they're starting another printing of this. I mean, they just got the thing back in print, and all those copies have gone. It's amazing how many copies we move, and people all across the country do. The Creature from Jekyll Island is must reading. And then the book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, by Professor Sutton. And then a book, Fiat Money, Inflation in France. And if you listen to our talk, we also have a four-tape set on the financial Armageddon. But if you listen to our talk or listen to our tape set or read these pamphlets, and especially The History of Money, you'll begin to understand that money traditionally down through the ages has had something of value behind it. The current system has nothing behind it other than the integrity of our politicians, the finest politicians that money can buy. And nobody has the courage to do what's right, and that is to raise the interest rates, slow down the economy, get contraction, try to get the money back into some semblance of control. And they're not going to do that, unfortunately, because, of course, they do not have the moral character to do what's right. We have a group of politicians in Washington, D.C., the finest politicians money could buy, and it is their advantage, of course, to destroy the value of our currency and hope that they can retire and live comfortably on the pensions that they're going to get, which will be indexed to inflation, but they'll have their free health care, all the wonderful benefits that accrue to those people who betray their constituents. Well, please, I remember our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, our webpage, radioliberty.com. Please pray for Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king, but the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be those of one of our favorite guests, Mr. William Grigg, formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine and now working with the Welch Foundation and certainly writing a blog for them, keeping their website going and just writing books, appearing on radio, and we consider ourselves very fortunate to have William with us, and he's usually here every Friday evening at this time and usually on one of our afternoon programs as well, because we want our listeners to hear what he has to say. Good evening, William. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well, Dr. Stan. Thanks once again for having me on your show.
Well, fine. It's good to have you. What are we going to talk about tonight? I mean, really, there seems to be such a dearth of important issues going on. Go right ahead.
Apart from the fashion craze that's been set off by Sarah Palin's hairstyle and designer eyeglasses, there really isn't a whole lot to talk about, apart from the unraveling of our banking system and the impending advent of the Greater Depression and the possibility of a war with Russia or some kind of a world war that would spring out of our involvements or improvident entanglements in the Near East and the Caucasus. There's nothing else to talk about.
Oh, don't forget about, Chris, the possibility of war with Central America. Russia setting up their military bases there in Venezuela and Bolivia. And Bolivia and Venezuela both evicted the American ambassadors. But people really don't understand. We're on the verge of the Third World War. How it'll start, we don't know. How it'll end up, you never know how war is going to end up. But our leaders seem intent upon taking us into a world war. And now with more and more countries having nuclear weapons, does anybody really think that America is going to be able to escape the consequences of the horror that we've inflicted on people throughout the world? And if God is just, is he going to let us sit over here calmly and quietly enjoying the good life as our troops wreak havoc in Afghanistan and havoc, you know, in Iraq? And now, of course, our troops are invading Pakistan. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, our troops are invading Pakistan. We have special forces troops invading Iran. Do you really think that this is going to go on indefinitely? But William, let's hear what you have to
really
say.
I'm really glad you brought up the fact that we have operations going on in Pakistan pursuant to an executive order signed by George W. Bush, and that, of course, involves us directly in conflict on the territory of a nuclear-armed Muslim state, the only nuclear-armed Muslim state so far. The nightmare scenario that I've been talking about and that you've been talking about for a number of years, one of those things that literally causes me to lose sleep at night, is the prospect of Pakistan falling under the influence of an Al-Qaeda sympathetic or Taliban-style government. And not many people remember that 10 years ago, Pakistan and India, which have been, of course, antagonists for over half a century, based primarily on religious sectarian animosities, and have fought a number of wars against each other. They were literally at the brink of a nuclear confrontation in 1998. And they still are in a state of submerged or subliminal war, if you will, with each other. The situation in the border between India and Pakistan is somewhat akin to the border between North and South Korea. The biggest difference is that in this case you've got actually two nuclear powers that are immense in size and population, and which are governed by ideologies that spring out of religious views that are nihilistic, that don't really view death as a defeat. Now, that particular combination is one of those things that I consider a witch's brew. And like I said, it has caused me to lose sleep on more than a few occasions. Now we've got U.S. Special Forces making border raids into Pakistan. I really think no good's going to come of this.
And, of course, then there's a serious question. Is it really? Well, we'll talk about that when we get back in just a moment. This is Dr. Stan. I just wanted to comment. One of the things that's really most disturbing is the story of Sybil Edmonds, and you'll find that in our January 2008 newsletter. And really it goes into the fact that Sybil Edmonds, working for the FBI, discovered that there was a spy ring operating at the upper echelons of the American government in the State Department, and it was actually shipping a nuclear technology to Pakistan. And, of course, it was done with the full knowledge of our State Department and the FBI. Nobody was allowed to stop it. And, of course, Sybil Edmonds wanted to get the story out and have something done because she thought it was wrong that the United States was allowing nuclear technology to be sent to Pakistan. And, of course, the federal courts upheld this, the Justice Department to put a gag on her honor. Mm-hmm. The appeals court, a federal appeals court, upheld the gag order. The United States Supreme Court upheld the gag order. And ultimately, Sybil Edmonds went to London, told the story, and it appeared in the London Times either the 6th or 8th of January. But what everybody has missed is why would the American government be intentionally transferring nuclear technology to Pakistan on how to build nuclear weapons unless there really were people in our government who wanted a nuclear war, and you can't have a nuclear war unless you have a nuclear adversary, and this is organized madness. Go right ahead, William.
Organized madness is perhaps the best word I can use to describe our foreign policy for the better part of the last century or longer, and that process you described whereby Washington has provided the essentials of nuclear weapons to either outright enemies or potential antagonists is something which goes back as long as there has been a U.S. nuclear program. And, of course, I'm not sharing anything with you or with your listeners with which you're not already familiar, of course, but go back and read from Major Jordan's diaries. You talk about the transfer of nuclear materials to the Soviet Union during World War II under the aegis of the Lend-Lease Act. And you can see where there was an effort by elements within the American government, which, of course, at the time was honeycombed with people who were double agents. They were switch hitters. They were playing for the United States and for the Soviet Union. But in the larger sense, they were playing for the same power elite, which has been behind both governments for a long time. But they were deliberately cultivating a nuclear capacity on the part of the Soviet Union. And the largest source of nuclear proliferation, if you want to take a look at the historical record, has been the government in Washington, which, of course, is involved in counter-proliferation efforts as well as the old story of the fireman who moonlights as an arsonist, perhaps, or the detective, the homicide detective who moonlights as a defense attorney, or to use Bastiat's favorite expression, or my favorite expression anyhow from Bastiat, people that create the poison and the antidote in the same laboratory.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with William Grigg. And this is Dr. Stan, and William, of course, has been expressing his concern, which I share, and that is we're moving towards a nuclear war with the Muslim world. And, of course, the Muslims would not have their nuclear weapons had they not been transferred to them by our own government, just exactly as, of course, during the Second World War, we transferred nuclear technology to Russia's, and that is told in the story from Major Jordan's diary by George Racy Jordan. And then, of course, the building up of Adolf Hitler prior to the Second World War, so we could have a fine enemy there. Building up, of course, the Russians who built up the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War so that they could provide weapons to the Viet Cong in the South to kill our boys. And as today, of course, we're funding the Pakistani government that's funding the Taliban that are killing our boys in Afghanistan. And none of this makes sense unless you understand that there are evil and wicked forces there that are really moving us, in my estimation, and I think William would agree, towards a nuclear war with a Muslim world and perhaps even with Russia and China, who we both supplied with wherewithal to build up their weapons. So pick up the story there, William.
It would be irresponsible, I think, not to talk about the possibility of a major war, perhaps a war of global scope that would go nuclear. It sounds alarmist to people who are not following the news, but really we're in a peculiar phase in our decline as a nation in which people can hear the most astonishing things said on television or on the radio with perfect candor and composure by policymakers or politicians who are standing for high office and absorb these things. The audience will absorb these things without really understanding the implications of what's being said. Sarah Palin, who's the vice presidential candidate on the Republican ticket with John McCain, and who is something of a darling of the social conservative right, in this interview with Charles Gibson of ABC, was talking about the fact that she wants to see Georgia, the former province of the Soviet Union, the Caucasus, and Ukraine brought into NATO. And one of the things that Mr. Gibson said in responding to this point was that if Georgia had been part of the NATO alliance, we would have been at war with Russia. And Sarah Palin made comments to the effect that she understands that and that we may eventually go to war with Russia. And it's, I think, amazing that that has provoked as little commentary in the press and as little public outcry as one would expect. You're talking about going to war with a country that, in terms of its theater nuclear arsenal, the assets that it has in situ there in the Eurasian landmass, substantially outguns the United States and its allies. So we would be ceding them an advantage, both geographically and tactically there, in terms of what they would have to bring to bear on the battlefield. We're talking about a country that retains a strategic arsenal, which is very, very formidable, and by some measures better than ours.
Well, actually, I've heard even that they actually have 10 times the number of nuclear warheads we do. And, of course, we've been graciously and benevolently unilaterally disarming. The Russians claim to be unilaterally disarming, but they haven't. And you have to ask yourself, why would any rational country, and the leaders, rational leaders of a country, be unilaterally disarming when the other side is not destroying their nuclear weapons or is not destroying them to the same number as we are, to the point where they actually have far more nuclear warheads than the United States does today? That just doesn't make sense, unless there's another agenda there that we don't know about.
Yeah, I could conceive of some circumstances in which we wouldn't be as concerned about the size and composition of the Russian strategic arsenal if our foreign policy were configured in a different way. If we actually had a defense establishment rather than an establishment devoted to the maintenance of an empire and the projection of power on behalf of a really obnoxious didactic global ideology, I think we would probably be better off right now, even with the present correlation of forces. I do think that one of the big problems here, of course, is that we've cultivated the worst elements of the Russian political and economic system, the same nomenclatura, the same party elite that changed itself by way of slapping on a new coat of paint and hanging out a different sign in 1991, from being the Communist Party to being various and sundry smaller parties, but basically the same coherent elite. They're the people, of course, who've been the recipients of all the largesse being directed their way from Washington and by the banking system. They're the ones who control the means of domestic regimentation, which they are presently using with a relatively lax hand by Soviet standards, if not by Russian standards, and of course they're the ones who control the strategic arsenal. And at the same time, we're cutting up trouble in the near abroad of Russia. We're getting involved deeply in the near abroad of a country that historically, in terms of the way that its population views the world, has not really been expansionist, but they are fiercely territorial. And in that sense, the government of the United States is really playing a useful role from the perspective of the Putin regime. We might as well call it the Putin regime. Yes, I realize he's no longer the president. He is unambiguously the one who's running things there. They need an external enemy. They need a rallying cry as much as our own establishment needs a rallying cry. And so when they feel, or rather when they project to their public, their populace, a sense of being under siege by the West and being encircled by Washington and NATO, that's something that plays very well into their own political calculations. They need something to help regiment that society.
But don't you think in a similar manner, we need an enemy.
Exactly.
We need an enemy to rally the people behind our government. And this is the oldest technique in the world. Plato wrote about that in the Republic, where he wrote, you know, when the tyrant has defeated the enemy by conquest or treaty and there's nothing to hear from him, that at that point he's always going out to find another enemy so that he can rally the people behind him. Yeah. Plato wrote that, you know, it was certainly 2,500 years ago,
yeah.
And it's just as true today, but they never teach that in our schools.
Well, they don't teach in our schools, but it's something that's very ardently taught to our political elites. I mean, they learn those same lessons either through tutorial or osmosis, I'm not sure which one, but that's certainly, of course, the case. You're exactly right. As things stand right now, we're not being told to pay attention to Russia or really being told to pay attention to China by the Bush administration so much as we're being redirected to look at Russia as a potential enemy now by either of the two major candidates who are running for president. The Obama ticket, both Obama and Biden have been very bellicose in their treatment of Russia. And, of course, John McCain and Sarah Palin have been even more bellicose. And either of these tickets, of course, they represent basically interchangeable, almost entirely fungible assets that are controlled by the same ruling establishment. Either of these tickets would have, as a matter of established policy, at least by way of their campaign rhetoric, a more confrontational pose toward Russia. The public hasn't yet quite caught up with this. I mean, obviously, there's a certain element of the Republican Party constituency that looks upon Russia with suspicion in large measure because of the Cold War. And, of course, there's a large element of the Republican Party that remembers what communism has been and continues to be in terms of a hugely murderous plague on humanity. And so there's a certain receptivity there that you wouldn't find necessarily in the Democratic Party's coalition, which is one of the reasons why I find it so remarkable that Barack Obama, who's a man of the left, and Joseph Biden, who's a man of the sort of squishy liberal element of the Democratic Party, both of them made a point of being conspicuously confrontational in their comments toward Russia. And that's what you'd expect from the Republicans, but the Democrat Party, of course, the type of people adhere to it, don't really cotton to that message as eagerly as the Republicans do, which is why that unanimity is all the more remarkable. And when you talk about the fact that governments are always looking for some way of rallying the public behind them to confront an enemy, I find it really interesting that yesterday, September 11th, the anniversary of the 9/11 Black Tuesday atrocities, it was the first time I actually heard it referred to openly and widely as Patriot Day. Now, I know that was a designation that went into effect a couple of years ago. We already have a Patriots Day. Patriots Day is April 19th, and that's not because of the Waco massacre. It's because, of course, of what happened at Lexington and Concord in 1775. And you really want to take a look at these two events, juxtapose them, and see there's a really interesting message being sent here and an interesting lesson being taught. The reason why a government would designate a holiday or designate a day to be some kind of an official commemoration is to sculpt the public mind, to sculpt public perceptions. I have never heard anybody associated with any government here in the United States, whether state, local, or federal, talk about April 19th as Patriots Day. I've never heard of a city or a state issuing a proclamation or a president issuing a proclamation urging Americans to meditate upon the meaning of what happened on April 19th, 1775. But, of course, the commemorations of September 11th are ubiquitous, very solemn, and they're accompanied with great liturgy and pageantry. And I think that that's because what happened on September 11th is being used to reinforce the idea that we are completely dependent on government for protection from these outside forces that menace us. And once again, we find ourselves being urged to define our lives with respect to the supposedly ubiquitous threat posed by the omnipotent troglodyte, which is my favorite way of describing Osama bin Laden, assuming that he is still in the mortal plane. I don't know whether or not he is, but of course he's not been apprehended. I believe that both you and I predicted immediately after September 11th, when Osama bin Laden was fingered as really the sole mastermind behind this atrocity, that he would never be brought into custody. And of course that's a prediction which is very easy to make. He was simply too useful as this Goldstein-like figure from 1984, the enemy of the state who was ritualistically shaken in front of the population during the 2 minutes hate every morning. You know, bin Laden was too useful of a figure of that sort until he became a bit of a political liability, and then he's ritually resurrected every year during what is now called Patriot Day. And a patriot is somebody, of course, who is willing to endure whatever the government sees fit to inflict upon him in the name of protecting the public from the omnipotent troglodyte and his minions. Interesting message to be teaching every year on September 11th.
I agree with you totally, and it's what a tragedy that we don't talk about Patriot Day. Patriotism is almost something that is not really popular anymore. It's a super patriot. I think they sort of demean that, and yet love of country is something that has separated, you know, men who really were willing to fight and die for an ideal from the vast majority who simply want to go along and get along. But this is the time we are facing the greatest danger this country has ever faced throughout its history, right at the present time. And we're going to do everything we can to try to get you to understand what is transpiring. We'll be back in just a moment here. William, go right ahead.
You make a wonderful point here about the fact that love of country is an eclipse where a sort of love of the government, particularly the most destructive element of the government, is now being taught as patriotism. A patriot is somebody who loves his country not because it's powerful, not because it's a superpower, as we now designate empires, but rather because it's his, because he has lived there, he has gotten to know it, he has been nurtured by it, he has come to appreciate in the very marrow of his bones the blessing of living on a particular plot of land that he understands among people he recognizes and loves. That's a patriot, and patriots of any land can understand patriots of other countries, too. I'm quite convinced that if you're a genuine American patriot, then you can understand and sympathize, for instance, with somebody who's a Russian patriot, because Russian patriots, true Russian patriots, not the ones who support the government, but the ones who love their country, understand that, really, their needs as patriots don't require the imposition on other people. You know, a true patriot of his country is the sort of a person who wants to live in peace and live in freedom as he understands it, as he's been given the wisdom to understand it, and he doesn't really see it to be his calling or responsibility to regiment the lives of others outside of the borders of his country or to regiment the lives of his fellow men who live within his country. Now, the Patriots' Day commemoration of April 19th, I think, is the sort of thing that our government would gladly want to eradicate altogether, because that was a story of genuine patriots, the colonial militiamen, who defied their central government in the name of liberty. I mean, this was a purely private act. Those who mustered in defense of the right to keep and bear arms to protect their communities against the depredations of a lawless central government obviously didn't have official permission from their government to do so. They understood that the chief threat to their liberty, the chief threat to their country, was the government that ruled them. Now, that's genuine patriotism. That's the American concept of patriotism. It sounds paradoxical to those who make the mistake of assuming that country and government are synonymous. Now, the idea that country and government are synonymous is what's being taught on the 9/11 commemoration that is now called Patriot Day. Your country and your government are synonymous. You belong to your government. Your government will protect you, assuming, of course, that you are willing to endure any imposition on your freedom, any imposition on your wealth, to surrender the lives of your children as they carry out tasks of supposed armed benevolence as missionaries of the empire in Mesopotamia or elsewhere. I mean, that's the vision of so-called patriotism, of faux or pseudo-patriotism being promoted on 9/11. And, of course, you cannot question what your government does. That's the other big lesson here. Somehow, by questioning what your government does, you're making the government less able to defend you from these unseen hordes of savages who are lusting with every breath to destroy everything that we hold dear. And only by having implicit faith in your government, only by believing in your government with the winsome idealism of a child, can your government protect you from these foreigners who would take these things from you. That's completely the opposite of the lesson taught by Patriots Day on April 19th. Now, April 19th, once again, reinforces, italicizes the idea that there are times when people who love their country cannot let the government that rules them take from them that which is most precious. And so I really think there's a striking contrast between these two dates. And it's of tremendous interest to me that there's been this emphasis on associating 9/11.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and there's really talking about Patriot Day, April 19th, and really the idea of how patriotism has really been sort of demeaned today. But I tell you, there are people who love their country. Solzhenitsyn loved his country. Solzhenitsyn left the security of America to go back to Russia because he wanted, if he in any way he could, to try to reestablish a free society in Russia. He failed, of course, just as those people here in the United States. many of them, you know, are willing to give their lives for their country, but the battle is not being fought in Afghanistan or Iraq. The battle is being fought here in the United States, and not with weapons, but with ideas, on talk show programs such as we're doing tonight, to try to make people understand that there are wicked and evil people who've seized control of the reins of our government. They operate through a number of organizations, but they control both political parties. They're intent upon plunging America into a terrible world war, destroying the value of our currency, enslaving our people, because their loyalty is not to the United States, but to the idea of a one-world government, a one-world religion, and, of course, the enthronement of a one-world leader. But pick up the story there, William.
I'm really glad you brought up Solzhenitsyn as an illustration of the point I'm making here about patriots of other lands understanding the difference between the government that rules them and the country that they love. And Solzhenitsyn is a perfect example of that. On my blog, Pro Libertate, a few weeks back, I offered as a case study one of my favorite athletes, a fellow by the name of Alexander Karelin, who was a legendary Olympic wrestler, national hero in Russia. He was actually elected to the parliament in, I believe, 1999 as a member of a party that's part of Putin's coalition. He's a few years younger than I am. He won his first gold medal in 1988 at a time when the Soviets were still the Soviets. He wrestled for the Soviet Union in 1988. He wrestled for the Russian Federation in 1992 through 2000. And he always considered himself a Russian patriot. He was born and raised in Novosibirsk, which, of course, is a part of the Russian Federation that is savagely beautiful. The man is 6'4", 6'5", and about 270 pounds. Of conditioned muscle, and his parents are of common size. I don't know how that happened. He was 11 or 12 pounds at birth. But the first thing he did after he won his first gold medal and had the political clout to do so was to call his mother and said, "Mother, you're quitting the party." He had his mother quit the Communist Party. He had been reading Solzhenitsyn. He had been reading Gogol and some of the other great literary figures of Russian history. Didn't care much for Tolstoy, I understand, but he liked Dostoevsky. But he once summarized the predicament of Russian patriots of his age by saying, "I love my country, but I can't really be proud of it." That is to say, he couldn't really be proud of the people who had been ruling his country and that had run its reputation into the ground, that had plundered that country and many others through this system of organized crime that is communism, that had ruined the patrimony that it inherited. Russia, of course, is a Christian nation. We can't forget that. Beneath all these levels of corruption and all these layers of oppression, there is a Christian society that still lives in Russia, and that's where their hope resides. And so when you see somebody like an Alexander Karelin or an Alexander Solzhenitsyn, somebody who has actually lived through an experience where their country has been taken over by people who are in the service of this power elite we're talking about and has been ruined and horribly mistreated and mismanaged and left a wreck and a hiss and a proverb, and you see these people still love their country enough to sacrifice in the effort to recapture some element of what it had been, it's really an inspiring thing. And I think, once again, that that's the sort of patriotism we're talking about. You have to love your country enough to confront the government that rules it. I mean, I think it was H.L. Mencken who once said that no honest man is ever proud of the government that rules him. And, of course, no honest patriot is going to be completely proud of the government that rules him. And that goes back, once again, to one of the basic points of departure for our republic from every other form of government that's existed. The men who wrote our Constitution understood that they were fallible. They understood they were fallen, sinful men. They understood that if they were given power, they'd abuse it. So what they did is they wrote a constitution to limit what they could do. They didn't trust the government when they ran the government. That's the American point of view. That's something which is really something of a revelation in human affairs, that you'd have people who have that degree of self-awareness that they could understand that they couldn't be trusted with power. George Washington would leave the room and somebody would start speaking of him in a complimentary fashion. He didn't want to be exposed to flattery. He understood how toxic that was, how dangerous it was. And there were, of course, mistakes that were made by all these men, but they understood they were going to make mistakes. Once again, I go back to the implicit lesson we're being taught when September 11th is designated as Patriot Day. That lesson is you cannot question your government. A true patriot doesn't question his government. A true patriot simply supports whatever his government does. Well, that's not patriotism. That's cultishness. That's a form of totalitarian nationalism. Nationalism in this sense being defined, of course, as believing your government and your country are identical.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is William Grigg. William, go right ahead.
I want to point out that when we talk about the prospect of war, and really there is no way of understanding how far this war would metastasize, how deeply and how broadly it would affect the entire population of the planet, we have to understand that's just one of the really ominous possibilities that looms in front of us. I mean, the other possibility, and this is actually something that's happening right now, is that we're in the early stages of what has to be considered an economic crisis that eventually is going to dwarf the Great Depression. And it's important, I think, for people to recognize, this is something we talked about before, but we cannot reiterate this too frequently, that a depression is not an unhealthy thing. It is the intervention by government in response to depression that makes things very bad for everybody. If you have a phase where people have made improvident investments, where they have borrowed too much, and they have mismanaged what they have had by way of capital, when you have an entire economy where this type of behavior has been abetted by a bank that issues a fiat currency, or it's been abetted in other ways, but generally you're talking about the types of banking systems that we have right now, a central bank that has a currency backed by nothing. When you have this type of behavior, eventually the economy being expanded too quickly on a very bad basis is going to have to contract. You know, people who've contracted debts they can't pay are going to have to make arrangements with their creditors. That's going to require that they downsize their standard of living. There are, of course, consequences passed on to creditors who've made improvident loans. Factories that have been, businesses that have overbuilt their productive plant are going to have to draw down. That's going to have some consequences for the people who work there. In other words, you've overbuilt, you've expanded too quickly, you've expanded artificially, and in order to reach economic equilibrium, there has to be a contraction. There has to be some kind of a negative phase where things revert to normal. The housing economy is a perfect example of this. People have been gulled into thinking that it is normal for the prices of homes to appreciate forever. It doesn't work that way. You're never going to have the type of parabolic expansion, or increase, rather, in the value of housing that will simply continue forever. It doesn't work that way. What's happening is that the prices of housing in these states where you see these rapid declines in the value of homes, that's a recovery. In other words, they're recovering back to normal. They're coming back to some level that is rational from being wildly overstated.
Hold that thought, William. We're going to bring all our stations back on board right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, William is talking about, of course, the contraction of our economy, which is the best thing in the world that could possibly happen. Certainly, what you do not want is the government to intervene. Let the free market work by itself. Economies always expand and always contract. It's when the government intervenes that you get into a situation very similar to the one we have today, for which there is no logical solution other than the ultimate collapse, hyperinflation, and collapse in the impoverishment of our people. Get government out of it. Allow the free market to work. Allow the interest rates to rise. Slow down the economy. But they're not going to give that a chance. I fear very much that they're going to resort to what they always do when there's an economic problem, and that is, well, let's create a war. Let's have a little war. That'll take the people's attention off what's going on, and they won't look to the politicians and blame them or the invisible government that rules us. They'll blame it on, of course, the wicked Osama bin Laden or whoever the current enemy will be, and it'll rally the people behind the government as the people are falling into poverty. But go right ahead, William.
Yeah, there is this deeply entrenched fallacy that is always invoked in circumstances like this, where people say, well, after all, World War II got us out of the Depression. It didn't. The United States economy did not recover until 1947 and 1948. At that time, of course, you had a Congress that was giddily and furiously paring back the spending of the government. You had the detooling of the wartime economy. You had people coming back and buying homes at reasonable prices, albeit, unfortunately, in many instances, money that had been given as part of the GI Bill. But the point is, it wasn't the war that got us out of the Great Depression. It was the return to normalcy, to use the phrase that was used after World War One. And what happens in depression, depressions become problematic, of course, when you've got clusters of errors that are abetted by the type of fiat banking that we've seen, where they pump liquidity, which is to say they pump inflation, into various parts of the market, whether you're talking about the tech bubble that burst in 2000, whether you're talking about the housing bubble that burst a couple of years ago, and people are just now starting to feel the consequences of it, or whether you're talking various other bubbles that have been set up. And, of course, when you have an economy that has expanded too far, it has to contract, and government will intervene in order to protect certain politically protected interests from the consequences of malinvestment. That's what happened during the last 2 years of Herbert Hoover's administration. Herbert Hoover has been caricatured in the public mind as a president who was a skinflint, who was interested in simply selling off and foreclosing and otherwise liquidating these non-performing agricultural and industrial interests. No, he was doing everything he could to intervene on their behalf with promises of taxpayer money in order to keep these keep the prices up and to keep these non-productive entities going. That's why things got so bad that by 1932, FDR, who was an inveterate socialist, actually ran a campaign where he flanked Hoover to the right. If you read the party platform, from the 1932 Democratic presidential campaign, it reads in some ways like a primer on free market economics. It was very consistently critical of Hoover for his intervention in the marketplace, his intervention in the economy, and promising that the government would get out of the way of the productive people and let free enterprise restore economic equilibrium. And, of course, exactly the opposite happened. I mean, it was like the example from the Old Testament when Solomon died. The taxes he'd imposed were very heavy. One group of advisors said, let's give the long-suffering Israelites a tax cut. The other said, no, we should tell them that they've been beaten with whips, and now we're going to beat them with scorpions. I mean, that's the same sort of thing that happened with the transition between Hoover and FDR. And that's why the economy didn't recover for almost 20 years. It was almost 20 years before we got out of that particular slump. And we're seeing the same type of thing happen right now, but it's much, much worse, first of all, because we don't really have the productive capacity, the industrial capacity that we had, the manufacturing economy that we had in the 1920s and 1930s. We're now a debtor nation. We owe more to more people than ever before in the history of the world. And, of course, the dollar is much weaker, and it's completely severed from gold. The dollar is a complete instrument of fraud. And so it's gotten to the point now where every week now we're seeing this drip, drip, drip of bank failures. We haven't heard this week's bank failure yet, but I hardly suspect, on the basis of what I've been reading just the last couple of days, that Lehman Brothers is going to get bailed out over the weekend, most likely by some kind of a treasury-backed initiative that would have a sovereign wealth fund from China buy out that major investment house. And that would put us once again in the position of promising China that when it comes down to it, our government is going to steal the wealth of the productive in this country, you know, small businesses and hardworking taxpayers, middle-income, lower-income families, anybody who qualifies to pay taxes of any kind. That wealth is going to be stolen, either through direct taxation or more likely through inflation, in order to pay the Chinese Sovereign Wealth Fund for bailing out Lehman Brothers. I'm pretty sure that's going to happen by this weekend. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, the Wall Street Journal actually predicted that it would happen sometime Sunday morning. They seem to announce these initiatives on Sunday, which, of course, is staggeringly perverse, to use the Lord's Day in order to consecrate, as they would see it, an act of force and fraud and grand larceny. It's just the sort of thing that our rulers do. But last week we had the Fannie and Freddie bailout. Fannie and Freddie, of course, are the government-sponsored entities that owned or issued more than half of all the mortgages in circulation, almost $6 trillion worth. And now that they have been nationalized, although the word's not being used here, it's being used by the British press. They're candid about what's going on. Hey, look, the Brits know from nationalization by the time Margaret Thatcher came to power in the late 70s, most of their economy was nationalized. So they can recognize nationalization when they see it. They're calling the Fannie and Freddie bailout nationalization. But between that, the nationalization of Fannie and Freddie and the FHA, the government now owns about 70% of all the loans, the mortgage loans that are in the system right now. So basically, we have seen the effective socialization of the mortgage market in this country, which is why Jim Rogers, the legendary hedge fund manager and investor, says that our economy in the United States is more communist than that of China right now. And the same thing's going to happen now. I suspect that Lehman Brothers over the weekend once again is going to get a Bear Stearns-type federally backstopped bailout, most likely from the sovereign wealth fund in China or by a cluster of foreign interests who are going to buy little pieces of Lehman Brothers, just buy off whatever assets they think are attractive and worthwhile. There's a remarkable story in today's Wall Street Journal. Just the last couple of paragraphs of it are the real stinger here, I think. Outside Lehman's headquarters in Midtown Manhattan, employees taking lunch breaks or a few minutes for a smoke early on Thursday afternoon discussed the firm's future. Many sounded dazed. "It's over, man. Unless we get bought out in the next 24 hours, it's over," said a young man in conversation with someone on his cell phone. He said he was a Lehman employee and declined to answer further questions. At a fast food vendor across the street, people waiting to order food discussed the dive in Lehman's share price this week. And the latest headlines from CNBC, outside a group of three men wearing Lehman badges and walking back into headquarters, discussed the fallout for other firms on Wall Street. "At some point, where does it stop?" one said as he headed back to the office. Well, it stops at such a point that the government has to monetize all these obligations it's going to take on when it's spending hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars to bail out all of these politically connected investment firms and banks. When it has to monetize these debts and suddenly people start dumping the bonds, the dollar-denominated bonds that they've bought up overseas, then it's over. Then we go the way of Zimbabwe. I mean, the Zimbabwean dollar right now is all but extinct. Zimbabwe, of course, is ruled by a demented communist who was brought to power by the connivance of Washington and London back in the 1970s, Robert Mugabe. He's destroyed that country's productive economy. He's driven 3 million people into exile. Their rate of inflation now is 12,000,000% a year. That, of course, is a record. Things have gotten so bad that the German firm that was selling them the paper they used to print the Zimbabwean dollar no longer is willing to provide them with that resource. So they have managed to achieve something I thought was impossible. The Zimbabwean dollar is at once worthless and it's also becoming scarce. I didn't think that you could actually have scarcity and worthlessness coexisting, but they managed to achieve that in Zimbabwe. But what happened is that their central bank is now conceding the reality that nobody wants to use the currency it's issuing. And so now, according to report datelined yesterday from the capital of Zimbabwe, the Zimbabwe dollar moved one step closer to extinction after the central bank authorized the use of foreign currency as legal tender in the country on the 10th of September. This announcement by Reserve Bank Governor Gideon Gono does little more than catch up with the realities on the ground. The use of foreign currency has been widespread since the elections earlier this year. The U.S. dollar and South African rand are in use in the country, while Botswana's pula is favored in Bulawayo and the west of the country. The Zambian Kwacha in northern areas, and the Mozambique Metakal in Mutare in the country's eastern regions. In other words, they're saying we're no longer going to be issuing a currency. Our currency has reached the point of metaphysical worthlessness. You might as well use currency from somebody else. Well, you know, in a way, that sort of a process is already going on right now when we have these sovereign wealth funds pouring what you'd have to call recycled dollars into buying up, propping up these investment houses. And other concerns. You know, Fannie and Freddie are backed by, kept afloat by bonds that they've issued to the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Russians. The Russians own something like $300-400 million in debt from Fannie and Freddie, which of course is not a whole lot, but it's enough to keep them operating for a quarter. but just keep them operating so they go out and get more capital. But the point here is that we're heading in the same direction. We have to be heading in the same direction because at some point, when they're not able to tax us enough to pay off the obligations, to meet the payout deadlines to foreign creditors, the only thing they can do, of course, is to adulterate the money supply. by hyperinflation of the sort that we're seeing in Zimbabwe. Perhaps not that dramatic, but it takes the same trajectory and will have the same impact, certainly on the standard of living of those of us who are trying to earn and save. And I wholeheartedly believe that the very next example we're going to see of that over the weekend is going to be this U.S. Treasury brokered bailout of Lehman Brothers. You take a look at the trajectory of their stock. March 12th of this year, they were trading shares at $44.95. 2 days ago, they were trading shares at $4.22. Now, that's pretty much the same profile that you saw with Bear Stearns. It's the same profile you saw with Fannie and Freddie, although they were able to defer their day of reckoning about 5 years. Their stock took that hockey stick-style plunge way back in 2003 when a number of us were saying, okay, well, eventually what this means is that Washington's going to have to nationalize Fannie and Freddie. Well, that's what happened, but it took them a number of years to do that. But these are the sort of things. These are all, of course, very potent indices that we are in not only the beginning phase of a depression, because, you know, you've got an economic contraction going on right now in the one part of the economy that was working, which was the real estate, housing, mortgage, and refinancing sector. But you also have the opening phase of these interventions by government that are going to prolong the misery as long as possible and then deepen the errors and spread the effects as far as possible by socializing them as broadly as possible. And all those things are what made the Great Depression of the 1930s and 1940s so miserable.
Well, I think one thing that is different today than it was in the 1930s and 40s is at least we had a gold-backed currency, and
yeah,
the Federal Reserve could not simply expand the money supply at their whim. Today, we no longer have those restrictions. And, of course, we could very well be moving towards something even worse than depression, and that is depression and inflation together.
Yeah.
And everything points that's exactly the way we're going. In an effort to try to fight off the inflation, they'll simply massively expand the money supply, and they're already in the process of doing that, probably at the rate of 13% a year today.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not going to let the American people know what they're doing until we pass the point of no return, and the average American has been impoverished in this incredible unfolding of just inadequate monetary policy that always follows when you get into a fiat money system, and that's where we are today. And there really is no way out other than a total collapse and the destruction of the value of our currency and the impoverishment of our people. This is my fear.
Well, mine as well. And when you talk about the possibility of a total collapse of the system, I'm reminded of what happened in Argentina about a decade ago. And really, we're headed in the same direction, but it's going to be much worse because our obligations are much, much greater than those of Argentina. But what's really ironic is that the Argentines managed to surmount that problem. In Argentina right now, you can live a very good life on very little money, but you can't get any loans. There's no credit available. And that's to be expected because that's how they got into the trouble they were in the first place, was through profligacy and through irresponsible lending. The two things go hand in hand, unfortunately. But if you're willing to live frugally and if you're willing to live productively, you can make a pretty good living in Argentina right now. As a matter of fact, I've got a number of friends who are thinking of expatriating themselves down there from the United States, which is something I can never do. I'm here for the duration. I'm not leaving. They don't get my country without a fight. But the thing is, a collapse of the sort we're describing, Dr. Stan, painful as it would be, and it would be hugely painful, I don't want to minimize in any way how unimaginably painful it would be to collapse, to see the collapse of our banking system, the functional collapse of our economy. But that is the sort of thing that has to happen when you have something so badly overbuilt, so badly overwrought, that simply cannot be sustained through anything but a huge exertion of official fraud and counterfeiting. And through the instrumentality of wars as a type of economic stimulus, that option that involves the possibility of a huge bloodletting, the likes of which our planet has never seen, is so unthinkable that an economic collapse is a preferable alternative if people can prepare for it. It's the sort of thing that would wrench everything that we're accustomed to out of our grasp. I mean, we'd have to recognize that right up front. Horrible privations would ensue. It would be tested in ways that we can't even right now foresee. But the point is, we're going to get some dose of that anyway, the way I see it. There's just no way of getting out of this particular situation we're in that doesn't involve that type of shock treatment. And I think it's better that we do it in a way that doesn't involve a paroxysm of global violence and the eventual loss of everything, because we basically deeded everything over to foreign interests. And, of course, the other possibilities we talked about before is that you'd eventually have the effective sell-off and buyout of the United States by whatever global entity is being hatched or being gestated right now in the womb of the power elite.
Well, because the other alternative, William, is that we would just simply inflate away our debt, and that's another very inconvenient way. And here would be the Chinese and the Japanese and the Russians and all these people holding American dollars that are absolutely worthless.
Yeah.
They could hold $1 trillion and it might not even buy a new car.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, what I really think that they have in the back of their mind. They know exactly what they're doing. They do not want us to know, and they certainly don't want the Chinese and the Russians to know. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I think the Chinese and the Russians understand this, and that's why they're not going to be left holding the bag that way. You know, they're many evil things, but they're not stupid.
In fact, right now, of course, they're coming in buying the New Jersey Turnpike, Chicago Skyway. They're even thinking about buying at the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
Yeah, buying it up right out from beneath us.
Right, and of course, they're buying up our corporations, they're buying up our infrastructure. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Well, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, Stan, I really appreciate you having me on once again, and I don't want to leave people with a sense of hopelessness here. One of the things that we have seen is that people are resilient everywhere, and Americans no less than people in any other country. As a matter of fact, we've got bragging rights, I think, in many ways. If you take a look at our history, there have been many challenges that would leave people, most people, particularly, I think, today, Americans living in the comforts that we've become accustomed to, leave them quite daunted by the prospect of settling the West or building and expanding what had been a free market economy during much of the 19th century. We don't have to start over from ground zero. We have the benefit of history and the benefit of the wisdom that we've inherited from wise and very brave men of the 18th and 19th centuries. Those of us who understand that this is ultimately a struggle about whom you worship and why know that we can count on our faith in God to sustain us amid much adversity, and we understand that God does intervene in the affairs of men, as Benjamin Franklin pointed out at the Constitutional Convention. That is a very tangible reality. That's the ultimate reality. And so if we're trying to do those things which resonate with his will, you know, the two great commandments, the Ten Commandments, we understand how the Golden Rule is not a suggestion but a requirement of life. We act on those premises in all areas of life, including politics, we'll be much better off, I believe.
I certainly agree with you, and of course, too, I certainly love the Lord with all of our heart and all of our soul, and our neighbor as ourselves. That's what it's really about.
That's what it's all about, ultimately.
Well, we're living in exciting times.
Our
goal must be to try to educate people, to make them understand that this is not a political battle. It's not an ideological battle. It's not a cultural battle. It is a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. There really are evil and wicked people out there that do have an agenda. Our job is to expose that agenda and hope there will be enough people who will join us in this truly epic struggle to determine whether or not we can survive. We can't do it alone, but William, I'm just hoping more and more of our listeners will convince more and more people what this is about, and when, of course, the wicked people finally try to establish their tyranny, why there are going to be enough people who are going to say no way.
Yeah, and I agree. And I have reason for optimism on that front, too.
Well, we have to be optimistic because the alternative is just too horrible to contemplate. But anyway, William, it's always a pleasure. One time, why don't you quickly give your blog spot?
Okay. If you go to it's a very simple thing to do. Go to freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Just type that in the search engine at the top of the page of your website. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. It'll go right to my blog, Pro Libertate.
We're out of time. Good night. God bless.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our program with William Grieg. I always enjoy it, and certainly there's a great deal of wisdom here. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, we're at the most trying and dangerous time in the history of our nation. financially, we're on the brink of total destruction, but our leaders are planning on taking us into a war in the Middle East and a war with Venezuela and a war with Russia and China. And you say, why would rational men want to do anything of that sort? And the answer is, because we're not dealing with rational men. Once you understand that, once you understand there is a spiritual force that energizes these people, you can understand what's going on today. I started the program this morning at my 7 o'clock program because we didn't have a guest. We talked about Gnosticism. And I hope that our listeners will go up in the Internet and look up Gnosticism or get out an old encyclopedia. And Britannica or Encyclopedia Americana, as I have, and look up Gnosticism and understand that this is a religion that believes there are two gods. One is the archaic, inferior God that the Christians and the Jews worship, and the other is the true God, who is Lucifer. And you say, what sort of madness is that? Well, it may be madness, but it's been around for a long time. It was around long before it was adopted by the Gnostics in the 1st and 2nd century A.D. It dates back to, of course, the ancient mystery religions of Egypt and of Assyria and of Babylon, and it has always been the message that's been out there. There is a force that you can tap into that will give you wealth and power, but only a very, very few will be introduced into this and to an understanding that you can tap into the other dimension and you can have whatever you want, but of course at a terrible, terrible price. They never tell you about that, and that is the price of your eternal soul. If you've not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, where we simply quote from Albert Pike's book on Masonry, Morals and Dogma, where he tells you the modern-day Masonry is all tied up with Gnosticism, that's really what it's about. This is a Luciferian religion, and many of the key people in our government are intimately involved with this belief or are controlled by that. And if you doubt that, we'll be glad to send you the little pamphlet put out by the Lucius Trust, used to be the Lucifer Publishing House. The Lucius Trust, the working of the spiritual hierarchy, and they will tell you how they have their people planted in both the East and the West, in government, in the military, in finances, in every level of government. That's the working of the spiritual hierarchy. And then go to the Internet, Sydney, and pull down the information on Gnosticism. Get my talk on the forbidden secret. The forbidden secret, or the secret knowledge. They're both excellent talks. I'll give you an overview of what's going on. You need to get the syllabus that goes with the forbidden secret to understand how this applies to today, and who the angel is, who rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm. A phrase that President George W. Bush used twice in his first inaugural address, and nobody has ever asked, who's this angel he's talking about? Well, you'll certainly want to get our talk on the forbidden secret, because there is a secret there, ladies and gentlemen, and nothing going on today makes any sense unless you understand that secret. And, of course, you begin then, of course, hopefully to help us disseminate the information that will be necessary if there is any hope at all for the survival of Christian civilization. So, again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, the number to get our items would be 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. 1-888-24-LIBERTY will take you to our answering machine here, our producer right now. But 1-800-544-8927 or 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, because we're on the front lines of this truly spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And Christian civilization is under attack today. That's why they took God and